It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After 48 years in broadcasting, Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson is retiring. He spent the last 21 years of his career working for Iowa Public Radio, but that's just a capstone on an extraordinary career. He got his start with the American Forces Vietnam Network in the late 1960s as a young Marine. He worked in commercial radio and television in Iowa and Hawaii. For 10 years, he was news bureau chief for CBS News in Bangkok, Thailand, and received a Peabody Award in 1989 for CBS radio coverage of the Tiananmen Square uprising in Beijing. Today, he is here with me to take a look back. Hello, Rick.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for 21 years at Iowa Public Radio.
Yeah, wow, time flies, and it has been a real pleasure. And I remember the early days when you were a student at WOI and passing each other in the hallways before dawn, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's go even further back in time. Let's go back to when you first got into broadcasting, which was kind of almost accidental. Tell me what happened.
It was after Marine Corps boot camp, and after training, you're given orders somewhere, and during the Vietnam War, most of the young privates getting out of boot camp had their orders to become an infantryman, a grunt, as we called the Marines, just long enough to go to Vietnam and hopefully come back alive or with, you know, pretty much the way you left.
Right.
And so I was very fortunate to get orders to go to a military broadcasting school. It was called the Department of Defense Information School at Indianapolis at that time. And it was just the luck of the draw, Charity. I would have been happy to have been a mechanic or any other kind of skill that you can use afterwards. But I can't take credit for it. That's where it happened. So it was 2 months of training, and coming out of that school, I had enough skills to become a broadcaster, and then a lot of OJT through the military. And my first real job as a reporter, where I actively used those journalism skills, was at the American Forces Vietnam Network in Saigon as a radio and TV reporter.
So when you got that assignment, I mean, as you said, obviously you were thrilled to get an assignment that was not putting you directly on the front line, but thinking, was that the first time you had thought about becoming a journalist?
Well, I did take a class in journalism in high school, but it was more or less just a routine class. So, yeah, that would have been the first time. I was basically ordered to be a journalist. I was told this is what you're going to do. And I was kind of a shy person. And one reason I didn't stay in college was because of some of the speech classes. And getting up in front of a class has always made me nervous and uncomfortable. And I wasn't really a very good student in the military broadcasting classes that I took. But fortunately, you know, you mature in your career and in your job, and it all turned out okay.
And you had volunteered for the Marines, hoping, of course, that, again, you would not be put in danger, but also because of the benefits of a military career and getting an education paid for, hopefully, when you got back, right?
Yeah, they had the draft back then. And so if you didn't volunteer, there's a very good chance that you would be drafted and forced to go into the military. And I wasn't really anti-military in any way, but if you go in voluntarily, you have a little bit more choice. So I went in for 3 years instead of the draft period of 2 years. And if you go in for 3 years, the military might consider, well, there's enough time to maybe give this guy some schooling and some special training rather than just an M16 and a helmet.
Well, and so many people were playing the odds back then, and clearly you did very well. I want to play just a little clip. This is the opening of one of your military newscasts on the Armed Forces Vietnam Network. This is from 1969.
Good morning. I'm Marine Corporal Rick Fredrickson with 5 minutes of news compiled from commercial and military news agencies. The word is no again from Israel's Prime Minister Golda Meir to any peace formula from the big four powers at Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
So that was your first job as a journalist, and there were a lot of challenges to that position, especially as you were growing as a journalist and learning about the world of journalism. Tell me about your work.
Well, at AFEN, I started as an overnight radio newscaster. And, you know, our assignments are for one-year tours of duty. So there's always people coming and going. And as people started to leave, some of them started leaving from their jobs in television. And I got a chance to do television news. And I did a little tryout there for the commanders at AFEN. And I was just great, Charity. I, like, didn't even make a mistake once. It was such beginner's luck.
Wow. Compared
to that radio newscast you just heard. If you'd heard that whole newscast, that's one of my most embarrassing performances. But I ultimately got into television. And then another opportunity was to become the Vietnam War news editor. At the age of 19, I was writing and clearing the war news coverage for radio and television across the AFVN network, which was radio and television.
Now, of course, at that time, I think people stateside weren't very aware of the work that you and your colleagues were doing in Vietnam. But later on, much later on, many, many people became aware of the work that you did thanks to the work of Robin Williams. And, of course, that's just a very short clip from the movie Good Morning, Vietnam, which Robin Williams played a character who was working at the Armed Forces Vietnam Network. Were there similarities to what he was doing and what you were doing?
It was an exaggerated portrayal of a news director and a disc jockey named Adrian Cronauer. But, of course, yeah, you're right. Robin is the most famous broadcaster of AFVN who was never on AFVN, and he's done more for outreach of our brand, the AFVN brand, especially in the post-war years. So we owe a lot to him. And in fact, I got to spend a day on the set as they were making Good Morning Vietnam. They shot it in Bangkok, and that's where I was living at the time. And I got to spend time with Robin Williams. And later on, during his visit to Bangkok, he was at the Foreign Correspondents Club and talking about the movie and about AFVN. It was like Robin Williams live in Bangkok. It was just
wow.
A real hoot. This was also in 1987 when the movie came out. And, of course, in hindsight, you know, he won a Golden Globe and was nominated for an Academy Award. It was just a real box office hit. So it was really sad when he died.
Well, and it also, the movie brings up some controversial subjects that I know you dealt with in your career. And I want to play another clip here. This is a clip of Bob Lawrence reading his censorship accusation on television news, and this prompted a congressional investigation. Let's listen.
In the military in Vietnam, I found that a newscaster at AFVN is not free to tell the truth, and in essence, to tell it like it is. Former newsman Mike Maxwell charged that there was censorship at AFVN, and now he's doing menial tasks in the record library and on FM radio. Rick Fredrickson leaves Tuesday. Rick tried to tell it like it is. Rick's a dedicated broadcaster. We've been suppressed, and I'm probably in trouble tonight for telling you the truth. I hope you'll help stop censorship at AFVN and any American station under military rule. Thank you and goodbye. Tom?
Give me a little bit of an overview. What kind of censorship were you dealing with?
Well, we understood that the military has every right to control the news in their ways. It was a military radio and TV network. We had no qualms about not telling military secrets or where B-52s are going to be bombing tomorrow. That wasn't part of it. But our news was being restricted so that the GIs in Vietnam could not hear the same news coverage of the war or of the protests in the United States that Americans would get back home. And that just didn't seem right to us. That seemed like censorship, and that's what it was. They had a list of words that we couldn't use. I couldn't even say, for example, South Vietnam. It had to be the Republic of South Vietnam, which was a little more acceptable to the government of Vietnam.
Well, we're going to take a short break. Rick, we'll be back in just a few minutes to talk more about your career and your experiences. This hour I'm talking with Rick Fredrickson of Iowa Public Radio, or at least of Iowa Public Radio until yesterday when he officially retired. We're taking a look back at his long and illustrious career. This hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, Rick Fredrickson, who spent the last 21 years working for Iowa Public Radio, first for WOI Radio, and then when the network was created for Iowa Public Radio. He spent a number of years before that, though, working in broadcasting. His career spans 48 years. He got his start with American Forces Vietnam Network in the late 1960s as a young Marine. After that, he worked in commercial radio and television in Iowa and Hawaii. He spent 10 years as the news bureau chief for CBS News in Bangkok, Thailand, and he also was a Peabody Award winner in 1989 for CBS radio coverage of the Tiananmen Square uprising in Beijing. And, of course, we've been talking about your career so far, Rick, and I want to return a little bit to the protest you were part of censorship on the Air Force or the Armed Forces Vietnam Network. And we talked earlier about how you kind of got thrown into journalism. This wasn't something that you had chosen as a career. The Marines kind of chose it for you, but you were a really young newsman. You were witnessing this censorship. Obviously, you were developing journalistic ethics if you were willing to stand up for what you were doing.
And I was also so young that I was easily influenced by those around me who thought that, you know, we weren't free to tell the whole story. And I believe that was the case. Our commanders were giving us instructions on what we could and could not say, and that came from their top commanders at the Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. There was a core group of us of maybe six or seven young privates, corporals, specialists, all enlisted men, and one young captain who was the news director that was involved, the core group that actually protested. And we heard Bob Lawrence a while ago. He actually went on the air in January 1970 and told everyone, after tipping off the civilian media to record his television announcement prosecuting the censorship case, it became just a huge story. I was on the Huntley-Brinkley News. We were on the Walter Cronkite News and Time and Newsweek and the wire services. And the commentators of the time were all weighing in on whether the military should or should not be censoring the news. We just basically thought that Americans in Vietnam should get the same news as Americans in the States. Of course, not trying to give out, you know, maneuvers and that kind of stuff. So ultimately, we did get a congressional investigation. There were a couple of military investigations prior to that. And I think about six of us, including myself, we were either taken off the air or transferred up country. I was transferred up country to a little remote island station and did newscast there to a very small audience, which was, you know, they split us up basically so we could no longer conspire.
Right. Did you think that was the end of your broadcasting career?
No. I thought it was good. I thought it was good for me. I really believed in that. But I've really, since then, I think we exaggerated, and I've really toned down my criticism of that era. Although others, including Adrian Cronauer, to this day, says that maybe we should have done more. But, you know, Charity, in hindsight, if the war were being prosecuted today with blogs and the internet and everything, it wouldn't have made any difference. And they should have just allowed us to say what we wanted to, because in wars today, our military men and women can just go online and see what we were trying to accomplish for the troops in Vietnam in that war.
You came back to Iowa in the 1970s, and then you worked in commercial radio, commercial television. I know recently KCCI ran a retrospective where you got to look back at some of the footage from your career there. Tell me a little bit about what you were doing in Iowa in the 1970s.
Well, I came home in 1970, and because of my training, even though I didn't have that formal 4-year degree, it wasn't quite as important back then as it is today. So I was able to get a job at that time. It was KRNT Radio and TV8, And I kind of worked my way up as a cub reporter. My first job in commercial radio and TV. I was the beat reporter for the Polk County Courthouse and did the morning radio newscast. And then again, started to work my way into television. And when I concluded my time with KCCI 12 years later, I was the co-anchor with Paul Rhodes at 6 and Russ Van Dyke at 10 o'clock, the first co-anchor for the stations when broadcasting was just kind of moving to the dual anchor format where a young person was paired off with an older seasoned journalist to kind of broaden the appeal. So that's where my Iowa career ended for that phase of my journalism career.
So you were appealing to the younger generation.
At that time I was.
You also, it's so fun to look back at those pictures. For those of us who've worked with you for many years, it's a lot of fun to see your very impressive beard and remarkable 1970s fashions. What is it like for you to look back at those years?
One word, embarrassing. I kind of look like a mountain man. I can remember the terrible letters that viewers would send in at KCCI TV, you know, calling me Rasputin. And there was a time when I just was tired of it and I wanted to get rid of it, but the managers at KCCI said, no, you know, it's part of your identity. You have to keep it. And of course, the guy in charge of promotions, photos, and making little video clips of the anchor team, he wanted me to keep it. Otherwise, he'd have to start from scratch to do Rick Fredrickson clean shaven. So I kept it throughout. And then when I moved to Hawaii, my first assignment was to go shave, and I was really thrilled to be able to do that. I was tired of it, and I've never had one since.
No, I mean, working in Hawaii sounds like a really tremendous assignment, period. But you really wanted to get back to Asia. Was that part of the plan in going to Hawaii?
I guess, because I immediately started to take vacations back to Bangkok, the Philippines, and Southeast Asia. There's something about veterans that they want to go back to their wartime roots, and where we were teenagers. So I started to go back as a tourist. And one time I went to the CBS Bureau in Bangkok and said, hey, I've worked for CBS television stations all my life. I'm a Vietnam veteran. You know, Thailand's next door to Vietnam. And they said, well, you know, we just lost our reporter like 2 months ago. We have no reporter. And of course, I went back to Honolulu and applied for that job. And I think a month later, I was the Bangkok bureau chief. So again, wow. A stroke of luck. It just seems to have followed me.
So, I mean, in addition to thinking about going back to that part of the world where you spent some really formative years, what was it that made you want to be there?
I think it was the excitement that I felt as a teenager in Vietnam. You know, living in a war-torn Saigon was just the I just have never been able to duplicate that feeling. You know, there's danger, there's a new career, there's youth. There's excitement, and of course, the best story in the world was the first real story I covered in my life. So maybe I'm just trying to relive or find the fire once again. And Thailand and traveling around Southeast Asia during that 10-year period, a lot of that was going back to Vietnam. Vietnam continued to be a huge story with the MIA POW issue. Of course, we had the embargo, and slowly Vietnam started to emerge from isolation. And I just went back dozens of times, so I got to see the old places where I was a teenager, plus cover the great stories all across Asia.
Well, and as the bureau chief in Bangkok, what was your beat? You reported from, what, 13 different countries? So where were you supposed to be covering? That's a pretty big assignment.
Wherever the foreign editor told me to go. Basically, I lived in Bangkok, and when stories happened in Thailand, it was convenient. But it wasn't just me, but stories in any bureaus, personnel at any bureaus around the world were subject to being sent where the big stories were. So if there was a big story in Bangladesh or India or the Philippines when Marcos was sent into exile, they would just kind of rally their employees from various bureaus nearby and send us all in by plane. Mounting a big story for CBS News, for example, the Marcos protests or Beijing, the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy protests. Dan Rather was there, all the top radio and television announcers and the camera crews. I mean, it was just dozens of people that formed just CBS News and every network and all the world newsrooms for radio, television, and newspaper were there too. So living in Bangkok just meant that I was closer to jumping into other hot spots and cover those as needed. But occasionally that was Bangkok too.
What did you do to try to understand the culture of the area? Because here you'd been in Vietnam, but grew up in Iowa, had spent most of your formative years in the States. This was a very different place.
Yeah, but people that now Thailand is a great vacation destination, and it has been for years. But back then, it wasn't as well known. But I guess it doesn't take long to appreciate the Thai people, their way of life. They make you feel special there. And, of course, the food and the exotic nature of a Buddhist country and all the temples. It's just a really welcoming, inviting place to live. The people are so tolerant that, you're just attracted by nature of the quality of life there. You're right. Every neighboring country is just a little bit different. But in Southeast Asia, there's something special. In Cambodia, the great story in Cambodia and Vietnam. Those are the three countries that I probably spent more time than any others. So it just was the lifestyle and a continuing excellent story at that time for a reporter.
Well, speaking of Cambodia, let's listen to a little bit of a story you did from Angkor Wat, one of the wonders of the world.
A blind musician sings for handouts in a corridor of the sprawling Angkor Wat temple complex, a monument to the prosperous empire that ruled centuries ago. Today, this artistic wonder is a refuge for Cambodians seeking shelter from the Khmer Rouge guerrillas. There is no authority here. The only tourists are journalists and UN visitors. Earlier this month, the fanatical rebels terrified the nearby province capital in a daring daylight attack. The United States has advised Americans to stay away. More than 800 years after this stone temple's construction, Cambodians are embarking on a new government. But at Angkor Wat, far from the capital city, power is determined by guns. And peace in this frontier will be decided by the whims of a defiant guerrilla group that opposed the democratic elections. Rick Fredrickson for CBS News, Siem Reap, Cambodia.
Rick, I think that throws into really sharp relief the kind of atmosphere of change that you saw when you were living in Bangkok, when you were reporting from that part of the world. Because, as you said, I mean, today Bangkok is an amazing vacation destination, but at that time, a lot of these countries that you were reporting from were not welcoming to outsiders.
Yeah, the history of these countries are based in war and upheaval and genocide. In the case of Cambodia, that what we just listened to was from 1993, when the United Nations held free and open elections then, and that kind of was the conclusion of the Khmer Rouge time. And that's one of the reasons, after 10 years, I think I came home, was the really dramatic nature of the stories became more business and economic and tourism stories, good news stories. And of course, no news is good news, I guess, unless you're a reporter. And as the story sort of withered and the network started to cut back their presence in these faraway places, it just wasn't as promising and lucrative. At that point, I was at the end of my time in Bangkok, I was more or less a freelance reporter, because CBS had closed my bureau. They were closing bureaus, as other networks were around the world, in cutbacks.
So obviously there was some pressure to look elsewhere for you. Did you also miss the excitement, though? Was it also partially just personal, the idea of maybe I've covered this story?
Yeah, but I was kind of ready to come back to Iowa at that point. Things were happening at home. My folks were getting older, and I'd gotten married. I married a Thai newspaper reporter. We met on the job, and so it was kind of exciting to bring her back and start our new lives in my second phase of journalism in Iowa.
Well, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Rick Fredrickson this hour. We're taking a look back at his 48-year career in broadcasting. The last 21 years, of course, were spent with Iowa Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson. After 48 years in broadcasting, he is retiring, and we're taking a look back. We'd love to hear from you as well. I know that many of you have interacted with Rick over the years. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rick, before we move on to coming back to Iowa, working at Iowa Public Radio, I want to talk about the extraordinary story that you covered, of course, that you won the Peabody Award for CBS radio coverage in 1989 of the Tiananmen Square uprising. And maybe first we should play just a little bit of tape from your coverage.
2 days before the arrival of Soviet President Gorbachev, Chinese students have returned to the streets by foot and on bicycle to renew their push for democratic reforms. Here with a group of Beijing University students on their way to Tiananmen Square, signs and banners carry their battle cry. Slogans encouraging more freedom. One says glasnost. A number of students are wearing headbands. Students on a hunger strike demanding sincere dialogue with the Chinese government. They're equipped with canteens and extra clothing. They say they'll fast to the end. As with previous demonstrations, this rally is peaceful with no interference from the authorities. Rick Fredrickson for CBS News near Beijing University.
And, of course, we know that the peace did not last. What was it that drew you to Tiananmen Square originally? What had been going on that gave you that assignment?
Well, originally, there was a Cold War between the Soviet Union, it was still the Soviet Union, and China, and this big summit between Gorbachev and the Chinese leaders was the first sign of a thaw and warming in relations. So they had this big diplomatic event that was scheduled, and media from around the world, and another one of those big media events. So I was sent there to be the lead reporter for CBS Radio. Again, Dan Rather and all the big TV people were there, all the producers, executive producers. And the Chinese students had been pushing for democracy for a long time, and they used this event with all of the world's media there as a stage to protest. And what we just heard was me marching with the students from Beijing University to Tiananmen Square, and that's what ultimately grew into a million protest demonstration, and it lasted for weeks. It was largely peaceful, and the Chinese decided to wait to really clamp down on these students until most of the international media left. You know, after 2 or 3 weeks, they were very tolerant of the student-led movement, and the Dan Rathers and all those folks left. You know, there's other news around the world. They can't stay there forever, and we weren't really anticipating that. I also had left when the crackdown occurred. I was also gone. There was just a small skeleton staff for CBS, and I imagine the same for others. So when the crackdown occurred and the famous photo of the protesters standing in front of the tank, there were very few reporters there, and that's how it was planned by the Chinese authorities.
Do you remember when you first heard of the crackdown?
Yeah, we're still in the same time zone, and I guess I was, you know, on one hand, sorry I couldn't be there to cover this tragic story, but also, you know, fortunate that I didn't have to live through it. But we had other people there to cover us for CBS, and, you know, that's the way it happened.
So you mentioned earlier that as political climates changed and the kinds of stories that you were covering were changing and CBS News was not giving you as many assignments, you were looking, I'm sure, at your options and thinking about your options. Was going back to Iowa, you mentioned the family pull, was that your first choice at that point, or what else did you explore?
I did think that was my first choice because I had a reputation. I'd been in the business here in Iowa. I thought I would be able to get a job. I had a new foreign wife, and a place like Des Moines, Iowa is a pretty safe place for someone to learn a culture with safety and learn how to drive a car here instead of, you know, L.A. or somewhere where it wouldn't be as easy. And that strategy, I guess, turned out. I was able to get a good job with a WOI radio at that time, and that's what began this final 21-year phase with public radio.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier, I was just starting my career in public radio when you came to WOI radio, and I do remember, honestly, a lot of us were like, what? Why would someone with this kind of experience and this kind of pedigree want to come work in our very small newsroom, which was extraordinarily small at that point, WOI Radio in Ames, Iowa? So we were surprised and thrilled that you were coming to be our colleague. Was it a little bit of culture shock for you to move into our not very glamorous digs there in the communications building on Iowa State University's campus and not have much of a staff?
Actually, it was glamorous compared to the places I'd been, and it was just
really saying a lot.
Well, we remember the old newsroom and our offices, but it really was a good job. You know, I'm still one of the legacies that goes back to Iowa State University, the one thing that was different for me is it was my first job in news management. I was hired as a news director, and that's something I'd never done before. So there was a challenge there. And the comfort of coming home, I think, don't we all enjoy that? So I'm one of those boomerang reporters who left and came back, and it's served me well.
As you were learning to be a news director and also covering stories in Iowa, now I feel like from my perspective, and I missed 10 years of your career in Iowa because I was gone, but it strikes me that you really eventually found what you absolutely loved doing, which is doing feature reporting and really digging into some historical gems in Iowa. Was there a struggle internally as you were trying to decide where to put your efforts?
I just always have been more of a loner when it comes to a reporter. And I, you know, it takes a certain kind of journalist to be a news director, to be able to manage people and budgets and schedules and dealing with the in our case NPR, and I just wasn't really cut out for that. I thought my best contributions for public radio was in reporting and feature reporting. There was one year that I hosted All Things Considered when it was still WOI Radio, but largely for the past 11 or so years, I've been this human interest, arts, feature, history kind of reporter, and I just love to be around Iowans and tell the Iowa story. It fits like a glove, and I think that's where my real strengths are.
Well, and absolutely, I guess I have the same opinion. You've done some really, really wonderful stories. When you think back on some of the wonderful feature work you've been able to do, do you have a couple of favorites? I know it's hard to pick.
Yeah. I think if the story that I'm most proud of goes back to terrorism, and that's something that has been kind of an overwhelming touch points throughout my career, from watching them disarm a huge truck bomb in Bangkok to 9/11 here in Iowa. I was the lead reporter for WOI Radio in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. We had just opened and we had an office in downtown Des Moines, and I covered the day of mourning, and I covered some of the really emotional, moving times here in Iowa after that. And the story that was kind of lost in that tragedy was what happened with the Sioux City National Guard. And I had spent a lot of time since then investigating these F-16 pilots who drove through the cornfields of Iowa on 9/11 and later that day were flying cover for Air Force One as President Bush was in Omaha, and then they escorted him back through the Midwest from Iowa that day. And part of that story was the last airplane in the sky, at least in our area. A woman was ferrying an aircraft to Kansas and had her avionics turned off and was flying towards Omaha from Wyoming to Kansas City. And one of our F-16s had to go challenge it and was prepared to take it out if she didn't finally turn up her radio. And that F-16 pilot just happened to be one of the first female F-16 pilots in the country. And this story just really came together nicely. I've done a lot of research since then. And that was a real memorable story because it got lost in the big news of 9/11. So I guess maybe I'd put that at the top of my list.
Well, and people may not know that in addition to the work you've done for Iowa Public Radio, you've kind of been doing extracurricular journalism as well. You are a writer and author of a number of, well, a book and several other stories, including the book After the Hanoi Hilton, An Accounting. So as you're looking at retirement, what are you hoping to focus some of your energy on?
Well, my friends and colleagues here in the Des Moines office, they probably joke about how, you know, I'm always thinking about military and Vietnam. I guess that's where my experience, my life kind of goes back to that. So I've been writing a book so far. It's about 10 years long, and maybe I can get to that and complete it, mostly about broadcasters that I've met and some of the really neat stories that I've spent a lot of time covering. And I'd like to put it down more as a record than anything else, because some of these things I was the only one there to experience. And I'm not writing this to make money or sell a lot of books, but just to kind of put it down on the record. And it's something I really enjoy. I've done some freelance writing, and I'd like to continue to do that and see what else comes my way.
Well, and when you do finish that, of course, you're welcome back on Talk of Iowa, Rick. So
thank you.
I'm eager to read it. And I just want to say thank you to you. 21 years at Iowa Public Radio, and it has been such an honor and a pleasure to be your colleague. I know I speak for many of our colleagues with those feelings as well. And thank you so much for talking with me today.
I've really enjoyed it, everything, Charity, talking to you now and the last 21 years.
Rick Fredrickson of Iowa Public Radio, after 48 years in broadcasting, he is retiring. He spent the last 21 years of his career working for us, for Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.